Hi, folks. This is Jack Spierko with another edition of the Survival Podcast. As always, one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, and the things we can all do to live a better life if times get tough or even if they don't. Today is Thursday, March the 27th, 2025, and this is episode 3,647 of the Survival Podcast. That means we'll hit a 50 next week, 3650. Just kind of an interesting number to think about, having done that many podcasts over the years. But today, of course, is a Thursday. That does mean it is time for an expert counsel Q&A show of the week. And I have got a banger lineup for you, including some people we haven't heard from in a while. Leading off, though, as always, Dr. Paul and Dan McAdams this week. With the Ron Paul Liberty highlights of the week, just as Saddam did not equal Al-Qaeda, neither does Iran equal the Houthis. The first part I completely agree with. The second part, I don't know. I don't know, so I'll have a little follow-up on that. Matt Sersley, getting your money out of an IRA without paying penalties. He has multiple strategies for doing that. Mike Melito will talk about drills and strategies to get over flinch and anticipation with handgun shooting. I haven't listened to that segment yet. I will when I put the show together for you, and I'll have some follow-up on it. There's a particular drill that I love for this, and I don't know if he'll include it or not. We will see. Andy McCann will talk about what to eat before a workout. I'll have some follow-up on this, including some remarks on what Stephen Lucas said when we ended up talking about health and nutrition at the end of a Bitcoin show yesterday. About needing carbs to work out. You know you don't, but you might. But no, you don't, but you might. How does that work? I'll explain it when I get there. Our Dr. Bones will talk about understanding hepatitis in austere situations. So, you know, if we have a long-term medical breakdown, there's a lot of things that can go wrong. It's a very serious medical illness and difficult to manage, specifically certain forms of it, in good times, so it's even harder in bad. Dealing with an aggressive turkey, Tom Turkey here with Jeff Lott, and I'll have some thoughts on this one too. My instinct is that some of this aggression, the higher levels of aggression, has to do with seasonality. Jeff hits on that, but maybe not from the standpoint that what might really be going on here. I'll just say that it's spring right now, and my gooses are bigger dicks than normal. Next up today, we'll have some discussion about alternative investment schemes, which is basically legal Ponzi schemes, and the Fed's politicization of the GDP forecast with John Pugliano, who's been off on a sabbatical for a while and is now back. And then I got an interesting one for you. This was spurred by Andrew from the audience, who really switched on Guy with Plants. He's a guy that I've learned a lot from, and hopefully I've taught a lot as well, too, over the years. Really cool dude. And he asked AI, what should we do about AI taking away jobs to be ready for our jobs to be taken by AI? I did a little follow-up after reading his. I'm going to go through some transcripts with you and tell you what I think about AI's advice about being prepared for AI to take away his job. I actually think AI's doing a pretty good job of giving you advice of what to do, and the advice isn't, you're screwed, human, go away. It's actually pretty well thought out and logical, and there's some other things we can extrapolate from it. So that's what we've got today. Before we get started, let me just remind you that you can always help support us by doing your online shopping at tspaz.com. That's T-S-P-A-Z, tspaz.com. Today's item of the day is the same as yesterday because it's still on sale and still in stock in the refurbished or renewed store on Amazon, which I won't go deep into. Just say renewed doesn't mean what you probably think it means. There's a link in the write-up where you can find out more, but it's just returns. It's not damaged items that were repaired. There's no money in that at the price point of most of this stuff. Amazon couldn't make that work, so this is somebody didn't want it, the box was dinged, whatever. And this is the TP-Link Deco AXC5300 Tri-Band Whole Home Mesh Wi-Fi System. I'll just tell you, if you want better performance in your home network, this is the tool. It's super easy to install. It works wonderfully. I've had 80 people pounding my network here, and it didn't even blink. Right? You'll probably never have that. It comes with three devices. One acts, it doesn't matter which one, they're all the same, but one acts as your router, so you swap your router out with it, and then the other ones link back to that, and you have Wi-Fi everywhere. And if you decide you want to add on more, it's just, you just buy one, bring it in, and install it. It's super easy. The app that comes with it, it'll put you at the level of like a systems admin, even if you barely know anything about networks. It's really super easy to use. It just works. The retail on it new is $254, $255 because 99 cents there. The price on the renewed version today is $199. This isn't going to be a product for everybody, but if you've been like, I need to upgrade my home network, now's the time, because the renewed stuff does not stay in stock for long and definitely doesn't stay in stock forever. With that, let's go ahead and dive on in and hear from Dr. Paul and Dan McAdams on, just as 9/11 did not necessarily equal Saddam being connected to Al-Qaeda, neither does Iran equal the Houthis today.
But segueing from that into our first topic is that Tulsi Gabbard, now she was on that call, but she went to Congress yesterday and she reaffirmed what the intelligence community, Big I, Big C, which is the collective agencies of U.S. intelligence, have been reaffirming since 2003. Iran does not have nuclear weapons. Iran is not building nuclear weapons. That's pretty big news.
Yeah, it's good. And that, of course, is an old argument they made. A lot of people died over the falsehoods on that whole message back when they were trying to build up the antagonism against Saddam Hussein and the Middle East wars, just how much suffering occurred by that.
Let's put that first clip up. This is from our good friends at antiwar.com, Dave DeCamp. He wrote up the article, did a spectacular job as usual. U.S. intel says Iran is, quote, not building a nuclear weapon. U.S. intelligence agencies have reaffirmed there's no evidence Iran is developing nuclear weapons. This is Tulsi Gabbard. She was before the Senate Intel Committee hearing yesterday, and she said, quote, the IC continues to assess that Iran is not building a nuclear weapon, and Supreme Leader Khamenei has not authorized the nuclear weapons program suspended in 2003. So they are not threatening us, yet somehow we're threatening them. You know, they're not able to threaten us without this weapon. Probably even with it, they couldn't threaten the United States. So what is the point of threatening them? Well, they say, oh, but our base is there. They could hit our bases. Well, let's get rid of our bases.
Yeah.
You know, but the U.S. is threatening them, and Trump is threatening them. The person who promised us no new wars and to end the old ones. Go to this next clip, because this is Trump just a few days ago talking about Iran. He said, every shot fired by the Houthis will be looked upon from this point forward as being shot from the weapons and leadership of Iran, and Iran will be held responsible and suffer the consequences, and those consequences will be dire. So he's saying something that's absolutely not true, which is Houthi equals Iran. It's absolutely not true. But you're right, what you said earlier, Dr. Paul, this is the same kind of sleight of hand that was used in 2002 to get the Iraq war up and running. Remember, Saddam equals Al-Qaeda. Saddam equals 9/11. He's doing the same with the Houthis. Houthis equal Iran. It's the same fake lying game, and it's dangerous. You shouldn't be playing it.
So on the macro, you can go what I think. I think we should completely unask the AO that is the Middle East. Everything the United States has done in the Middle East has made everything worse, and we should stop touching it. Right? When everything you do, when you touch something, makes it worse, a small, smart person who is not a sociopath says, gee, I'm doing more harm than good. Even if I want to fix it, clearly I can't. And they stop touching it. Use that as a foil against what I'm about to say, right? Because what I'm about to say is going to be sounding a little bit like disagreement, but it's more of uncertainty and honest uncertainty. So the contention here, and everything I agree with right up to this point, is, but Iran is not involved with the Houthis. They're not providing. So what the accusation by our government is, and remember, I doubt everything government says. It doesn't mean that it's always wrong, though. The Iranians are the ones that have the technology to provide targeting data to the Houthis. Is that true? The honest-to-God answer that anybody has to give that's not privy to all the intelligence, and I'm not, nor is Dr. Paul, nor is Dan McAdams, I don't know. because this is not a simple one where, here's an example. When they said Russia blew up the Nord Stream pipeline, anybody with an IQ over like 75 should have immediately went, well, that doesn't make any sense. Putin controls the other end of the pipeline. If he doesn't want gas to go through it, he just doesn't put gas through it. Like, it benefits Russia in no way to do this. So it was an obvious lie right from the beginning, regardless of how you felt about the issue itself, right? Like, you had to be stupid, and you still have to be stupid. You have to be more stupid to believe it now than to believe it then, since it's basically come out that, yeah, all the conspiracy theorists, hello, here we are, we're right, again, okay? So I doubt government, and then sometimes government says stuff that's so freaking ridiculously stupid that not only do you doubt government, you just go, that's not true, that's bullshit. Okay, this isn't one of those. Iran is a state sponsor of terror. They absolutely are. They do shit like this. They do have fairly advanced technology relative to the Houthi rebels in Yemen. They could be doing this. They also may not be doing this. I don't really know. But I don't think it's as simple and clear cut of, you know, like, Saddam Hussein obviously was not behind al-Qaeda in 9/11. Like, that just didn't happen. That never happened. It never was a thing. And we knew it was not a thing, and we wanted to invade Iraq, so we did it anyway. Like, that's pretty obvious. This here, I don't know. I don't know. I just don't know. Now, the comments about Iran not pursuing a nuclear weapon. Not only is that appear to be true, I think there's a bigger thing going on here that's actually good news, and that is this renewed relationship between Russia and the United States is doing some things to take some pressure off that steam right there, with Russia saying, look, what Iran's saying they want to do is build nuclear energy. And so what if we provide them the ability to make nuclear energy, and you can see what we're giving them, and it's all stuff you can't make a bomb out of? Now, I know some of you are very skeptical about that. I find that easier to believe, okay? I find that easier to believe than Iran has no connection whatsoever to the Houthis. You see what I'm saying? There's room for doubt here. But here's the thing. Even when you disagree with somebody, you can agree on the macro, and that is the smart thing for us to do would be not be there. Move our shit out of there. We have no business there. It's not ours. Right, like, one of the few things that you can really glean from science fiction is the Star Wars philosophy of the Prime Directive, basically a doctrine of non-interference. It's not isolationism to not bomb another country. It's not isolationism to not tell another country how to run their country. Isolationism is where you seal up your borders and you do no trade and no interaction whatsoever. That's isolationism. What we're talking about here, and this is where Dr. Paul and I and his whole crew agree 100%, non-intervention. If you intervene, there will be problems. This isn't hard to figure out. Let's go on to something else. Let's talk about getting money out of that IRA where you feel like it's captive and you're going to pay interest and penalties and what have you with Matthew Sersley.
Hey there, TSP crew. This is Matthew Sersley of AgoristTaxAdvice.com. Got some questions on the Telegram channel about how to get money out of an IRA. First thing to understand is the difference between a Roth IRA and a traditional IRA. Pretty much any money you take out of your traditional IRA, you are going to pay ordinary income tax on it. For Roth IRA, it's a little bit different. First of all, you are allowed to take out your contributions to your Roth IRA tax-free at any time. So if you put in $20,000 over the past 5 years, you can take that $20,000 out. It's only the growth that you can't take out of a Roth IRA. And please note, that is a rule that only applies to Roth IRAs, not to Roth 401ks. I've seen people mess that up. Now, ordinarily, you need to wait till you're age 59 and a half to withdraw the funds from a traditional IRA or the gains from a Roth IRA tax-free. But there are other ways to get the money out a little bit early. First of all, for your first time home purchase, you can take up to $10,000 out penalty free from either a traditional or a Roth IRA. You have to meet certain requirements to do that. That is a $10,000 lifetime limit. And for a Roth IRA on this and many of these other things, the Roth account needs to be at least 5 years old, or there still may be tax on it. Additionally, you can use money from an IRA or a Roth IRA for qualified higher educational expenses. So this can be used to pay for tuition, books, and fees for yourself, your spouse, your children, or your grandchildren. Again, you still pay tax if it's a traditional IRA. You still pay tax on the gains if the Roth IRA is less than 5 years old, but you at least avoid that 10% penalty. If you have a lot of medical expenses during the year, and it really does have to be a lot of medical expenses, over 7.5% of your adjusted gross income, you can withdraw that amount penalty-free from your traditional or your Roth IRA. Again, traditional IRA, you're still going to pay regular tax, but you avoid that 10% penalty. This is one that I actually learned doing some research on this. If you lose your job and you are on unemployment for at least 12 weeks, you can withdraw money penalty-free from your IRA to pay for any health insurance premiums you have. So let's say that you have COBRA or something while you lost your job, you're on unemployment, you're having trouble coming with money to pay for your health insurance, you can use money from your IRA to pay for that. If you become permanently disabled, you can withdraw the money from either a traditional or a Roth IRA penalty-free, any amount, anytime, but the IRS has specific rules for disabilities. Typically, you're going to need to be found to be disabled by Social Security, but there are some ways where you can qualify for the IRS rule even if you're not disabled under the Social Security rules. Military people, if you are on a reservist and if you are called up to duty, you are allowed to withdraw money from your IRA to pay for various expenses regarding keeping your family life going, paying your house, etc. So as long as you're called for duty for more than 180 consecutive days, you can withdraw IRA funds penalty-free. If you have either an adopted child or the birth of a child, you can withdraw $5,000 penalty-free to pay for costs of the birth or the adoption. That withdrawal has to be done within 1 year of the birth or the adoption of the child. One nice thing about this one is you can actually repay that money. So most of these, the money comes out and you don't get to put the money back in other than the standard caps, whatever they are in the year you're doing it. But with this particular way, you can take the money out now and then you can, get the money back into your IRA later so it can grow. If you have an inherited IRA, first of all, congratulations. But any money you take out of the IRA will be without penalty. And in fact, depending on the type of IRA, you must start taking the money out typically within 10 years of the receipt of the IRA. It needs to be fully drained. But that is one thing to know, that if you inherit an IRA, you don't wait until you're 59 and a half. You take it out and it is penalty free. Now, finally, there's an incredibly complicated rule called the SEP rule, the Substantially Equal Periodic Payment Rule. This basically that you retire before age 59 and a half. You cannot have a job while you're doing this. And it basically lets you set it up almost like an annuity, where you say, I will take this amount of money out of this IRA every single year until I die. If you're going to do this, you need to work with a tax professional because it's very hard to mess up the formulas on this. And if you're off by a dollar, you will pay the penalty on the whole amount that you take out before you're 59 and a half. But if you are somebody who's been putting that money away and you've got, several million dollars in your IRA, you're ready to retire, this can be a way to retire before you're 59 and a half. IRAs are great ways for people without a job to legally avoid some taxation. I'm a big fan of having a Roth IRA or a traditional IRA. If you have any questions or want to talk with me about this or anything else, please schedule a free call with me at agoristtaxadvice.com/TSP. Hope to hear from you soon.
So just the one add I'll have to this one is, just remember, kids, if you just do a Roth IRA, you can always take out all the money you contributed tax-free and penalty-free. You just can't take out the interest and dividends, etc., that you've earned on the money that you put in, because when you do a Roth, your money was already taxed. And I will tell you, Matt knows that and all, but there are a lot of people, including CPAs, etc., who still are not with the plan on this and do not understand. It's just filling the form out the right way. So let's say you have a Roth IRA and you've contributed $100,000 to it over the years, and there's $280,000 in there. It's done fairly well. You can take up to $100,000 of it out and pay the government not a effing thing. And this is why I always, and I don't care about your one attempted exception about why it would be better if. This is why I always recommend the Roth option with IRAs or 401ks. And if you work for an employer who has a 401k plan without a Roth option in 2025, you need to go to your HR Karen and you need to annoy the shit out of her until she gets a plan in there for you with a Roth option. Because there is no reason at all for anybody to have a 401k without a Roth option today. It doesn't change anything for your employer. It doesn't cost them any more money. It has absolutely no impact on them whatsoever. And I thought it didn't exist. And just last week, I heard from two people based on a comment I made that emailed me that said, I have a 401k at work, conventional only. And I told both of them, go pester HR Karen and just like once a week, hey, Karen. Are you going to get us our financial guy in here from Edward Jones or whoever? We need a Roth option. Karen, hey, what about the Roth option? And get other people in the company. What about the Roth option, Karen? Why don't we have a Roth option? Do you hate us, Karen? Why, are you too stupid to know how Roth works, Karen? Be a little nicer, but you get my point. Badger, because the squeaky wheel, it gets the grease, not just in the military, in all things. Next up, let's talk about handgun drills with Mike Melito.
Hey, TSP. Michael here from Gunfighter Life Podcast, coming at you with another Q&A segment. This one's from Aaron. He says, can you suggest some drills and strategies for overcoming recoil anticipation when shooting handguns? I am left-handed and consistently shoot low and right. He goes on, we'll come back to it. A seemingly simple question. If you didn't think someone could wax philosophic on handgun shooting, you're about to hear it. Handgun shooting, to be competent with a handgun, requires dedication and training. There are some things you can do, which we'll get to, but there is no quick fix, no hack for this. Everything is solved by a meme or a tips and tricks or a whatever 5-second long TikTok video. Being a good, competent handgun shooter requires training and dedication, and it is a very perishable skill. I dare say there are a lot more people that have handguns than there are competent handgun shooters. The most consistent problem with shooting a handgun is people dropping the shot, flinching, anticipation, call it whatever you want, usually for a right-handed shooter, shooting low left. In this case, for the lefty, shooting low right. This is the major issue with handgun shooting, and people have different levels of natural ability, just like any other thing, in different disciplines, and some people have that in handgun shooting, but nobody popped out of their mama loving a controlled explosion happening in front of their face, which is what handgun shooting is. Just a few notes from my background for some bona fides here. I am a state pistol champion several times over. I was a law enforcement, FBI, handgun instructor. I have taught more military, law enforcement, and civilians than I could even try to put a number on. Be wary of anybody that says they have a quick fix for this problem. Because if they did, either A, they have some secret that nobody else knows about, not Navy SEALs, not Green Berets, not FBI. Well, those guys know about it, or else they would just do this quick fix and they wouldn't have to train all the time with a handgun. Either that or it's snake oil. Getting rid of this issue, being able to relax and focus on the front sight or the reticle, depending on your handgun, focusing on that crystal clear and just letting everything else take its course in due time, not anticipating that shot. It takes training, and practice. It sounds simple to do, and it is, but something being simple and being easy are not the same. It's like, how do you run a marathon? Well, you probably know how to run. Just do that for 26.2 miles, and you ran a marathon. Super, super simple. Not easy. Handgun shooting. I can tell you how to be a great handgun shooter in like the next 10 seconds. Align the sights properly, put them on the target properly, and hold the sight picture there until after the shot breaks. You do that every single time, and you will be a world-class handgun shooter. That's it. It's simple. It's not easy. It requires dedication and training. It is a perishable skill more than shooting a long gun, much more than shooting a long gun. Shooting a long gun also requires training and discipline, but handgun is a much more perishable skill, a harder weapon to master. It's one of the reasons I love it. It requires real grit if you want to be good at it and consistently good at it, cold and on demand. So although I'm going to give you some things to work on, it's going to require you to actually put in the work. And a lot of people have handguns. Doesn't make them a competent handgun shooter or make them competent with a handgun. Just like I could give somebody a guitar, best guitar, whatever guitar Jimi Hendrix used. I don't know, I'm not a guitar guy. That doesn't mean he can get up on stage and play like Jimi Hendrix. Handgun, I can give you a really good handgun, but you have to practice with it to be good. Now, Jack gave a drill, which I will get to, but the number one thing I'm going to tell you is dry fire, dry fire, dry fire. All the top shooters that I know, they all have one thing in common. They all dry fire. They all dry fire. Dry fire. There are some things you need live ammunition for, but a lot of times you will get better faster with dry fire than you will with live fire. By dry fire, I mean practice with no ammunition, no live ammunition in the gun. Snap caps or an empty chamber. With most modern guns, that's not going to affect anything. You're not going to break your gun. Dry fire. Hold your sights on target. Keep them there. And focus on those sights not moving through the firing cycle. If you're fairly new to this, meaning like you don't have hundreds of thousands of reps in and you tell me the sights don't move, I'm going to tell you you're not paying close enough attention. Because I do this, except for Sabbath, almost every day. And I, again, state pistol champion several times over. And my sights move most of the time, like 9 out of 10 times. It might not be enough to get me off target, but I know which way they move. It's a hard thing to hold that in front of your face and do all the things and have a perfect sight picture where nothing moves and you just hear a click. So yours is probably going to move. And your goal is to minimize that, minimize that, minimize that, until one day you get that perfect shot and everything just clicks and everything was dead solid. And that requires dedication. But dry firing, if you can do that with no bullet, assuming your handgun is sighted in, the target is honest. The target doesn't lie. Wherever the hole is in that target is where your sights were when the shot went off. If you can do that with no ammunition in a dry fire, you can do a live fire. If your mental game is solid. And like many other sports, the mental game is the most important one. But if you can do that, you possess the physical skill to do it. If you start dropping your shots with live ammo, the drill that Jack suggested is a very good one. And that's the ball and dummy drill. Just like dry fire, except you mix it in with live fire. You can load up a couple of magazines yourself or have a buddy do it and load up the gun, and you won't know when you have a live round and a dummy round. And then you will very quickly see that you are, in fact, dropping your rounds, anticipating that recoil. It seems like you already know that you do that. This can be a good fix if you already know proper form and you're starting to slip into that to get you back on track. You first have to know how to do it properly to begin with. You also mentioned that you're doing this with a 44 Magnum and a 10 millimeter. Shoot with a 22, shoot with a full-size 9 millimeter, and see if you are still doing that. If not, I bet you can deduce what the issue is. Waxing philosophic here, what is the goal of shooting? What is the goal of having a gun? Is it to make noise? Is it to look cool on Instagram? Or is it to get hits on target? I don't care what the caliber is. If you don't get a hit on the target with that bullet, the caliber is irrelevant. So think about that. I know it's a seemingly simple question, but it does require some honest discussion of bigger issues. Going a little bit longer, I hope Jack decides to keep it in. I think it's important. I'm not here to be your snake oil salesman. I'm here to give you quick tips akin to putting duct tape, broken radiator hose, I'm here to try to help you be better with a handgun that requires dedication and training. Thanks, guys. Thanks, Jack. Have a blessed day.
Well, he did get my drill in there at the end, and I'm glad he did. I don't have to explain it now. I will just say that it is the most powerful drill that I've used in teaching other shooters and in keeping myself doing things the right way. Now, I will also say this. I am not the greatest handgun shooter, and I probably haven't run that drill myself as much as I should with a handgun. But at handgun ranges, you know, I'm fist-sized group, but... Yeah, we could all be better, and remember, you always fall back to your lowest level, not your highest level of training in a stressful situation. But where that technique, that drill, has worked wonders for me isn't really been with handguns. It's with shotguns. And shotguns specifically shooting skeet and clays. But this is why I think it's very effective for handgun shooters as well. We've all had the experience. You're working with a shooter, you're watching them shoot, you tell them you're picking your head up off the stock, you tell them you're pulling low left, whatever, you know, you tell them you're anticipating, and they say what? No, I'm not. And in many instances, what I'll do is have them shoot, and now that everybody has a video camera, you know, like super high quality HD video camera in your pocket, I'll video them. And I'll show them what I'm talking about. Head position, a lot of things I can do that with. But there is something, and it is more powerful than when you're dry firing. See, when you dry fire, you know there will be no recoil. You're very focused on it. It's a very useful drill. It really is. But when you're out at a target and you have somebody load your weapon for you, hand it to you over your shoulder, and you slow fire at a target, and one in, let's say, five rounds fail to discharge, you see what you're doing in a way that you will never see just dry firing alone. It's something that it goes in and it registers with the brain and it connects to the muscle memory. And then you understand what you're doing. Usually with a handgun, it is, you know, to your opposite of your hard side. So, you know, most people that shoot low left are right-handers and they kind of just pull because they're anticipating that recoil. And even, you know, I've had people tell me that have this problem, but I don't fear the recoil. You don't fear it. It doesn't mean that you're not reacting to it before it happens, right? Like, somebody, a grown man shooting a 9mm shouldn't be afraid of it, especially if you've done it before. It's not painful or anything. It's not like shooting a .458, you know, Winchester hot load out of a rifle that beats the shit out of you. But we still react to explosive things moving in our hands. So I really think that is a great drill for everybody to do in every discipline. With that, let's go ahead and hear from Andy McCann on what to eat before a workout.
Hello and good morning. This is Andy McCann coming to you from Woodstock, Georgia, where I own CrossFit Garage, a gym to help you get healthy and fit. And I had a question on Telegram, and I'm not on that often. I need to get on there more. And anyway, I had a question on Telegram, and several people at my gym asked nearly the exact same question because they know what I do. I eat keto, or very strict keto, or carnivore in this lion diet with Evan and his crones. Anyway, right now we're doing the CrossFit Open, and so the question comes up, hey, what do you eat before you really want to throw down in an event? Or the general question is, hey, what do you eat before you work out? All right, so the answer is always, it depends. If you aren't really doing anything and you're just getting started, then it doesn't matter. Don't change anything. I suppose I could tell you maybe don't eat a massive amount of pasta before you go out and work out because you're going to see it again. So if you're just starting the journey, just, you know, get into the habits. But I'm going to answer this like it's me. What do I do? And if, especially if I want to do really well or compete. So I've saved up like for the open. So typically for me, I'm eating 6 eggs in the morning when I wake up. I have about 30, 40 minutes for it to digest, and then I go to the gym. But I'm also not looking to throw down all the time. If I know I've got a serious workout that I really want to do, I want a more clear stomach. So I'm probably going to eat maybe 2 hours ahead of time so I have enough time for that food to get out of my system. Also, I would probably throw in some avocado or maybe a little bit of a sweet potato. I would definitely drink some coffee or have some caffeine, and I'd make sure I'm taking my electrolytes, whether it's one you made on your own or the LMNT. Any of them will do. Just make sure you're well electrolyted, especially if you're doing carnivore. Now, if you're a normal human, not weird like me, and you want to just perform a little bit better, then I would take it in stride of how do you feel after you work out? So if you feel dizzy or lightheaded after working out, let's say you're working out in the morning and you're done and you're like, we're in the middle of it and you just feel off. Well, did you eat anything? If you didn't, then I would try eating something before going in. Typically what I would do is a spoonful of peanut butter or maybe a small whey shake, so some whey protein and some water. I don't know if I would do milk. You'd have to experiment with that. I guess the real thing is experiment with everything. So give yourself a spoonful of either peanut butter, almond butter, or something, and see how it goes. If it doesn't quite fill the void, then maybe add 2 spoons of peanut butter, or make your smoothie a little bit larger. The thing you want to, struggle against is how full will you be? It's kind of hard to exercise on a full stomach, but I do these long adventure races where we're in the woods for 12 to 24 hours, and you have to eat while working out, because there's no other time to eat. You have to eat, right? So I'm kind of used to that. Now, again, I wouldn't eat a big thing of spaghetti, but everybody's going to be a little bit different. Having something in your stomach is better than not, but not everybody reacts the same. Go slow and steady. Again, start with peanut butter. Maybe add a hard-boiled egg or a scrambled egg. Depends on your time frame, right? So I had a buddy who was trying to solve for pre-diabetic, and he was like, well, I want to take my protein smoothie before I work out. I'm like, yeah, but what are you solving for? Movement? Or pre-diabetes? And he's like, well, diabetes. I'm like, okay, well then how much sugar is in that smoothie you're drinking? And it's a lot. So watch out just by going to some unnatural foods or shake foods like a drink. You're probably going to start ruining some of the other things you're trying to do. So I would lean into real foods first if you can. If time is a crunch, then like I told my buddy, hey, you could always make some hard-boiled eggs the night before, and then you just have to crack them and open them. Or you can even pre-open them if you want. So it doesn't have to be difficult. Obviously, your body wants to burn carbs, so it's going to pull all those carb storages first. If you're like me with no carbs, then it's going to pull from fat first. Your fat is your longer burner or a slower burner. Because we live in America, it's never going to pull from your protein because you can just go eat something. So you don't have to worry about that. But carbs are a faster energy source. You have 3 pathways that you're diving into for a workout, and it kind of depends what you're doing. Is it a 2-hour jog? Is a one rep max back squat, right? So it depends what you're doing, what you may want to eat or the energy you have available. Okay, so that's the morning. But what if you're an afternoon workouter? Well, that's the same sort of thing. If you lack energy, you're feeling like you're dragging into the gym, then I would actually treat myself, make it a pep talk. Like, I'm not a huge fan of going to, Starbucks and getting a very sugary, fun drink. But if you're about to go work out anyway, and it helps motivate you and give you a little pep, then go ahead and do it. So the idea behind fueling for your nutrition is if I give myself the appropriate nutrients and energy systems, then I'll be able to utilize my time better in the workout. So it's much better to be able to go in our case, it's CrossFit, right? So we want to work out hard for like 8 minutes. If I go in and half-ass it for 8 minutes, then I'm kind of missing the point of it. So I would do coffee, electrolytes, and some sort of food. Now, I would probably not eat a steak before working out either because that's just going to be heavy. But on the flip side, if my buddies were like, let's go, hike Blood Mountain, then I probably would eat a steak because I need food that'll last me the long time. I need proteins and fats because I'm not going to eat the carbs. All right, guys, I hope that helps. I'm going to turn this into, I think it's going to be episode 200 on my podcast. I'm going to go a whole lot deeper into specifics and other energy systems. If you want to jump onto food, fitness, and finance, you'll find me there. Guys, you can always go to the link that I created just for y'all. It is crossfitgarage.com/TSPC, and you'll see all the free stuff that I've been developing as you guys ask questions. Guys, take care, and as always, if you need help, you can email me, andy@crossfitgarage.com. Take care.
So kind of the thing I want to talk about here is this idea of needing carbs to work out. Not really in relation to what Andy said, but something that was said yesterday by my guest, Stephen Lubka from Swan Bitcoin. I didn't take him to task on this because we're in different worlds, and I believe in people choosing their own diet, and Stephen's a very healthy guy. But his assertion that, like, to work out in the gym, to lift weights, whatever, that you need carbs is just wrong. But it's not wrong, but it's wrong. How does that make sense? Am I going into a mental loop here? No, it's right for him, but it's not right, period. It depends. I'll put it a different way. We all know, and this is a sore subject for me, some of you know why from years ago, but if you put gasoline into a diesel truck, you have problems, right? Like, the truck will literally shut off and not run, and it's a lot of work to fix it. However, let's imagine that it's not quite that simple. Let's imagine in an imaginary world that you can put diesel in a gas vehicle and gas in a diesel vehicle, and they'll both still run, but they won't run optimally. So then why does the diesel truck run on diesel fuel? Because it's a diesel truck. In other words, it's engineered and designed to run on diesel, okay? And then the gas vehicle is engineered and designed to run on gasoline. So if you put the wrong fuel in the wrong vehicle, you get poor performance. And honestly, if you put some of the wrong fuel into that vehicle and it's still mostly the other fuel, that's exactly what you'll get. You'll get poor performance, but the vehicle will still run, albeit shitty. Your body is not a car. You are not a mechanical machine. You are a biological machine. And you are an adaptive biological machine. So the reason that a person who eats carbs and doesn't eat a diet that is meat and fat centric and very low carb thinks they need carbs when they go work out to have more endurance is because they do. Because they have biologically adapted to be carb fueled. Don't tell me that you need carbohydrates to work out, and then let's look at Sean Baker or Ken Berry and the fitness level those men have. Let's go look at Sean Baker, who's 67 years, 63 years old, somewhere in his 60s, and has multiple world records. He's a bodybuilder built legitimately like a brick shithouse. He's got a world record for rowing. Like machine rowing, like somehow they measure that and they all compete against each other. He's got the world record in one of the events for that. And he's in his 60s. And he has that record in his 60s. It's not from 20 years ago. Why doesn't he need carbs to work out? How can this man live on beef almost exclusively? Because his body's adapted to it. This idea that you need to eat differently because you're going to work out is retarded. I'm sorry. It just is. No, you need to find the diet that works for you, and then that's how you need to eat to take a shit, to work out, to do your office job, to go work in the garden. Like, once you find the right diet for you, then it's the right diet for you. You don't need to carb up because you're going to go lift some freaking weights. Do you think our ancestors, for God's sakes, carbed up before they went and pushed a boulder to build something? No, they did not. We are human beings, and we are incredibly adaptable as an omnivore. It doesn't mean that it might not be the case that our optimum diet is meat and fat-centric, low-carb. And again, I'll just say ancestrally. That's what we ate. And anybody that doubts it, you're confining your assessment to a few thousand years in reality. Even if we go back, agriculture is 10,000 years old. Yeah, in parts of the world, to some degree. But if you go back even a few thousand, 3,000, 4,000 years, and then you get outside of the few cities and civilizations that existed at the time, and then just look at what people had to pick from to eat, it becomes really clear what they ate. Now, if we go back 10,000 years, that's the case across most of the planet, as far as we know anyway, and we know humans were around for at least 300,000 years of that. So it's 10,000 years versus 300,000 years as to our evolution. You see what I'm saying? That doesn't mean you can't be healthy eating a plant-centric diet. Not plant-based, I don't know, but plant-centric, certainly. But it has to be high-quality food. And it will work either way, depending on you, your adaptation. And I do think there is both epigenetic and genetic components to what's optimum for people. Just some thoughts I have on that. Let's move on now. And next, we're going to hear about your liver and hepatitis in austere situations from Dr. Bones.
Hi, Joe Alton, MD here, also known as Dr. Bones of the survival website doomandbloom.net, co-author of the Book Excellence Award-winning fourth edition of the Survival Medicine Handbook, and designer of quality medical kits at store.doomandbloom.net. There are all sorts of diseases that may confront the caregiver in off-grid settings, and some affect the entire body and others affect a particular organ in the body. Today we're going to talk about the human liver. Although the body's largest organ is, surprise, the skin, yeah, the skin is actually considered an organ, the largest internal organ is the liver. The liver is reddish-brown, sort of cone-shaped, and is located in the upper right-hand corner of the abdominal cavity under the diaphragm at the bottom of the rib cage, and over the GI tract and the right kidney. In most people, it weighs about 3 pounds. The liver is so important to survival that any impairment in its function can be life-threatening. It has many duties, including production of bile, which is a fluid that you need for digestion and absorption of fats in the small intestine, filtration of certain toxins from the blood, like alcohol, let's say, storage of certain vitamins and minerals like vitamin A, B12, D, E, K, iron, and copper, regulation of building blocks called amino acids that are needed to make protein, maintenance of normal levels of glucose, that's sugar, in the blood by storing and releasing it as needed, production of cholesterol, yeah, you actually do need cholesterol, producing urea from toxic substances like ammonia in your body that is then excreted by the kidney, so it works with the kidney to do that, processes out old blood cells, and even produces certain hormones. So you can see how important a functioning liver is. If the liver is diseased, it can become enlarged and tender. This compromises its ability to perform functions like helping your body eliminate toxins, digest food, store energy, and all sorts of other stuff. So how can the family medic evaluate the liver? The simplest way of evaluating the liver involves standing on the right side of the patient as they lay flat on their back, and you use one hand, or two if the person has a big belly, starting halfway between the right side of the belly button and the person's side. The liver will feel more solid than the surrounding intestines. What you need to do is slowly and gently press downward as the patient takes a deep breath to see if you can feel the solid edge of the liver. At first, you probably won't that far down, but it's a good starting point. You have to then move steadily upwards each time during the patient's deep breath in until you're just under the lowest rib. In a normal-sized liver, you might not feel it at all, or perhaps barely feel it under the rib during the deep breath. If you can feel it without difficulty, without the breath, and during this exam, it's likely going to be enlarged. Let's talk about liver inflammation. Hepatitis is the term that's used for inflammation of the liver. Mostly caused by viruses, this condition disrupts the body's ability to process toxins and can be life-threatening. Besides viral infections, alcohol abuse and certain drugs can also lead to hepatitis. The drugs, believe it or not, include even innocuous-looking drugs like Tylenol, especially if you use it excessively over time. Chronic liver diseases and autoimmune conditions can also cause liver inflammation. The symptoms can range from none at all to life-threatening. The hallmark of hepatitis is something called jaundice. That's a yellowing of the skin and eyes that occurs due to an excess of a yellowish substance called bilirubin in your system. Bilirubin is formed by the breakdown of old red blood cells in the liver. That's one of its jobs, remember? A healthy liver eliminates bilirubin as part of this process. Other symptoms you may notice include a loss of appetite, nausea and vomiting, diarrhea, fever, dark-colored urine, pale grayish bowel movements, so definitely a strange color, stomach pain, itching, that's very common in people with jaundice, muscle and joint aches, fatigue, and a general ill feeling that's also called malaise. There are various types of hepatitis listed as A, B, C, and D. No, and E, actually. Each has its own characteristics, but many symptoms are similar. Some types are related to poor hygiene, others from poorly prepared food or contaminated water, and some are even transmitted sexually. All are contagious and have the potential to cause liver dysfunction and perhaps long-term scarring. Let's start with hepatitis A. Hepatitis A is caused by oral fecal contamination. It can be gotten, for example, by drinking water that has particles from the bowel movements of infected individuals. It begins as a flu-like syndrome and then quickly manifests many of the symptoms that I just mentioned, like jaundice, 2 to 6 weeks after exposure. It can also be transmitted sexually. In normal times, a restaurant employee who doesn't wash his hands after using the bathroom can pass this disease along to customers. In survival, failing to purify water, well, that can cause an epidemic of hepatitis A, and that could greatly affect your group's general health and work efficiency and overall survival. Hepatitis A usually gets better, though, without treatment after a few weeks. And interestingly, children rarely get symptoms while 80% of adults do. Next is hepatitis B. Hepatitis B can be spread by exposure to infected blood products, also bodily fluids, vaginal fluids, semen, things like that. Symptoms are usually indistinguishable, though, from hepatitis A. It looks just like hepatitis A. Hepatitis B, however, can cause scarring in the liver, which leads to a chronic condition known as cirrhosis. That's C-I-R-R-H-O-S-I-S. In cirrhosis, the functioning cells of the liver are replaced by non-functioning nodules that give the normally smooth organ a lumpy appearance. Cirrhosis can also be caused by a long-term use of alcohol or certain recreational drugs. Besides jaundice, this condition can actually lead to a long-term complication known as ascites. That's an accumulation of fluid that causes swelling in the abdomen, legs, and other symptoms. Then there's hepatitis C. I'm sure you've read about hepatitis C. It can cause acute or chronic infection, seen most often in older individuals. It can be contracted by intravenous drug use, a transfusion, or unsafe sexual practices. A percentage of these patients progress to cirrhosis over time and sometimes complete liver failure. There is a vaccine that's now being actively promoted by the government that may protect infected individuals from future damage. Unusual hepatitises are like hepatitis D. The hepatitis D virus is unusual because it seems to only occur in people who have an active hepatitis B infection. So in tandem, the two viruses can cause a significant superinfection, can be very dangerous. And then there's hepatitis E. That's typically an acute infection that's sometimes associated with eating poorly cooked pork or wild game. Luckily, it's self-limited, which means that it gets better without treatment after several weeks. Some types of hepatitis E virus can be spread by oral fecal contamination, well, similar to hepatitis A. Off the grid, the family medic's not going to have modern medical technology, but they can still help the patient recover. It's important to make them comfortable by encouraging rest, assuring good hydration. You can give antihistamines like diphenhydramine, Benadryl, as needed for symptoms like itching. There's a few detoxifying and anti-inflammatory herbal remedies that may help support a liver that's afflicted with hepatitis. Some of these supplements include milk thistle, artichoke, dandelion, turmeric, licorice, red clover, and green tea. Now, these aren't cures, but they may assist your other efforts by having a restorative effect. And there are nutritional strategies, too, that might have a good effect, too. You avoid fatty foods and alcohol, increase your zinc intake, decrease protein intake, improve your hydration status. A lot of people are walking around dehydrated all the time, and especially use herbal teas, vegetable broths, and diluted vegetable juices. These are supposed to be very good for this. It's also important to practice good hygiene by washing hands after using the bathroom and before preparing food, washing dishes with soap and hot water, avoiding eating or drinking anything that may not be properly cooked or filtered, making sure children don't put objects in their mouths, that's important, using condoms to prevent sexual transmission, and not sharing personal items, if at all possible, like toothbrushes or razors, with infected people. Although viral diseases are difficult to treat off the grid, many can indeed be prevented with a plan of action. You focus on prevention, and you'll ensure your people will keep it together, even if everything else falls apart. This is Joe Alden, that old Dr. Bones, wishing you the best of health in good times or bad. Thanks for listening. Hey, learn about more than 200 off-grid medical topics in the award-winning fourth edition of the Survival Medicine Handbook. Get your family medically prepared with quality kits and individual supplies from our entire line at store.doomandbloom.net. You'll be glad you did.
All right, next up we have a rage-infused turkey, and this can be a problem. A rooster can be a problem. A turkey can be a bigger problem, especially an aggressive tom. Jeff Lawton has some thoughts on this.
Hi, Jeff Lawton here, coming to you from the Middle East in Jordan, where I'm on consultancy at the Green in the Desert project. I have a question here about an aggressive tom turkey. He's attempted biting, beating his wings, charging the dog and the owners. They've had this before with a blue slate turkey, and now they've got a bronze-breasted turkey, and it's doing the same thing, so I think they're doing something wrong. Their birds are penned up in the cold weather and when there's not too many predators around. And I think this is a combination of things. Sounds like they're feeding pretty well, but when insect season stops, this is when the behavior starts. So I think he's a bit short on quality feed, and he's a bit restricted in area. So I think when you get them a bit too tight in area, they get very protective of the females, like roosters do. Now, you've got them in with chickens as well. So watch that, because chickens can get blackleg from turkeys and vice versa. Turkeys and ducks go well together. In fact, the ducks will forage behind the turkey scratch if they're out in the forest, which is interesting to watch. There may be some issue about being in with chickens. Look that up. You'll see what people talk about there. I've had turkeys in with muscovies. They go real well, muscovy ducks. I think you're going to have to bring your feed up and give them a bit more protein. And more than normal if he's in a small area. So it's either give him a bit more area, give him a bit more space and better food, or if you can't give him more space, really bring the food up on him while he's confined in that small area. It's obviously a frustration. And don't let him get away with it. Give him a good knockabout when he comes for you, if you can. But you'll get exactly the same thing with big chicken roosters. In a small area where they're a bit deficient on food and scratch activity, they'll get aggressive. But a turkey's a much bigger bird to deal with. So I can understand your frustration there. So, yeah, give them a bit more area. Give them a lot more food, especially some extra protein. That might be expensive, but you might be able to sort out some cheap sources. And I can understand your frustration this winter. So it's none of that so easy to do. There you go.
I definitely agree with everything Jeff said, but I also think there just may be a seasonal component to this with mating season and becoming more aggressive during that time, because you know, you're coming into winter, you come into spring, that's, you know, turkeys like geese and other poultry, most are not like chickens or ducks that lay throughout most of the year. They lay in a fairly confined period, 60-day-ish period, and all the breeding happens around that particular cycle in the females. And during that time, males tend to become more aggressive. My geese are not really aggressive. They're like the least aggressive geese I've ever seen. These pilgrims, they just seem to be chill. Right now, the female's laying eggs. She's trying to go broody, but I don't know if she's going to get it right again. And the two males are absolute dicks. Now, they're not actually doing anything because they're cowardly dicks, but their neck out, hissing, throttling their feathers, flapping, and just being general nuisances. And I know full well by the time summer gets here, that will be over. That behavior will cease, and it will come back next year. They're not the problem that this turkey is. You know, they don't have spurs, etc., and they have no willingness to commit, right, to an attack. They just kind of, like, bluff. Turkeys can be kind of dangerous. They're fairly large, even a smaller breed. Big spurs, and they're designed to fight. Like, that's what they do. Now, I will also say, though, in my opinion, that turkeys generally turn on people when they start to see people as a rival. In other words, they're not trying to attack the human. They think you're a Tom. And so you have to be careful. I say this about roosters all the time. If you just smack the shit out of them when they act that way, you'll reinforce that delusion. So one of the things you can do is offer them feed when they're being aggressive, because another male would never do that. But I think this bird could use better diet during this time of the year and more freedom and liberation. And it may indeed be the case that by having this communal poultry thing, chickens and turkeys together and all, that they're more crowded in, and maybe it's causing more stress on that bird and making him more of a dick. Anyway, with that, let's hear about some investing questions from John Pugliano.
Hello, TSP. I've been on a short sabbatical from answering questions. I had some personal things I needed to take care of. I am back. For those of you whose questions I haven't answered, I apologize. If you contact me directly, I'll get you a personalized email answer. In the meantime, I do have two really relevant questions I want to try and fit into this segment. First question comes from Mike, and he's asking about the company Boxable, which is not yet publicly traded. It's kind of in that category of alternative investment and the rule changes that have allowed non-IPO companies to market their shares to regular everyday investors. And you're seeing more and more advertisements for alternative investments, private placements. And I get a lot of questions about these. I would just encourage you to be very skeptical and cautious when you hear these sales pitches, because that's exactly what they are. They are sales pitches. Remember, when Wall Street pitches these deals, their primary focus is to make money, right? To make a profit. And they have little regard for how the investment works out for you long term. And if you don't believe that, which I know with this audience, you're probably very skeptical and you do believe that, but just think what happened during the financial crisis when all those subprime loans were packaged up and sold to individual investors and institutions as low-risk, income-producing instruments. I think a lot of what we're seeing now and will see in the future with these alternative investments is going to be a replay of the subprime loan fiasco. And think about it in these terms. You have literally thousands of zombie companies that have been borrowing money at rates that have been held suppressed by the Federal Reserve since at least the financial crisis, if not really going back to Greenspan in the early 2000s. And we're in a different regime right now in terms of where inflation and interest rates are. And all these companies are now and over the next couple years having to refinance. They've got to refinance at a much higher rate than what they've paid in the past. And I call these zombie companies because even with the extremely low interest rates, they either weren't profitable or made a very small minimal profit. So the only way they're going to stay afloat is to get a cash injection. And I think they're using these alternative investments as a way to sucker unsophisticated investors. Ha, my two cents. Anyways, specific to Boxable, I've only looked at this at an extremely high level, so take what I say as a grain of salt, and I might be wrong. But when I look at their SEC filing, that's a Securities and Exchange Commission, you can Google that and go online and find the information. But if I'm reading it properly, it looks like Boxable already has well over 3 billion shares approved for issuance. Now, I think they only have around a billion or so that are actually issued, but they're authorized a total of something in the range of over 3 billion. That's billion with a B. So don't look at the fact that you're only paying 80 cents a share for it. Look at the overall market capitalization and how much 3 billion shares adds up to. And to put that in perspective, a company like General Motors, you know, the big car company, they only have a total of a billion shares authorized. So again, hey, it's only 80 cents a share. If you want to throw some Las Vegas money at it, have fun. But my quick take on it is that the numbers just don't add up. And speaking of numbers not adding up, Fred has a question about the GDP Now forecast from the Atlanta Federal Reserve. Now, this is a widely quoted forecast about the current GDP of the quarter that we're in. And if you've been watching it as of late, it's been literally all over the map. Fred's specific question is, do I think a recession is coming because that Atlanta Fed GDP Now is currently predicting negative growth for the first quarter of 2025? Well, Fred, I wouldn't put any weight into the Atlanta GDP Now forecast. And I say that especially now because I think they've taken a very political tilt to their analysis. And also remember, there are 12 regional Federal Reserve banks, and each one does some varying forecast. Specifically to the Atlantas, they're not talking about just their region. They're projecting negative GDP growth for the entire U.S. economy. But you compare that to the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, which is currently, as I record this, projecting GDP growth of 2.7%, while the Atlanta Fed is projecting a negative GDP loss of 1.8%. I think their numbers are insane. And again, highly politicized. The reason I say that is that literally just 2.5 weeks ago, they were projecting an even lower estimate of something like negative 2.9 or negative 2.8, something along those ranges, which is, again, it's 180 degrees out of phase with not only what the New York Fed is projecting, but even the Atlanta Fed themselves. If you go back to the beginning of February, they were predicting GDP growth of over 3%. So it's always been minutia. The reason I say it's being politicized is that The mainstream media has picked up this story. They're really running with it. I think they're trying to create the narrative of a coming recession. They're putting all the blame on Trump policies of everything from tariffs to federal worker layoffs. And the reason I emphasize that this is political is that the GDP Now forecast is supposed to be projecting what the current state of the economy is. And for the most part, no tariffs have really been levied, nor have there been big government cutbacks or huge amounts of federal workers losing their paychecks. I mean, most of these furloughed workers are still receiving their checks and just not showing up for work. So while that potentially could be showing up in the economy next quarter or the quarter after, none of it is actually hitting the economy right now, the real economy. I mean, there's uncertainty evolved with the stock market fluctuations. But for the Atlanta Fed to be projecting this much of a negative GDP in this quarter when nothing's actually taken place, I think is pure politics. One other thing, and I'm out of time here, but consider this. A lot of what their projections are based on is the potential unemployment rate of all these federal workers. Well, what were the numbers? Something like 25,000, which again, are still receiving paychecks. And even if you add in ancillary contractors, and I've seen the numbers as high as, you know, two or three contractors could be laid off for every individual government employee, but still add up the numbers. There's over 163 million working Americans. The percentage being affected by proposed government layoffs really barely moves the needle. And the real question is, are there really ever going to be any layoffs? Or is there really going to be any decrease in government spending? I think all that's totally up for question. And the other side of this is, and this gets back to where the Fed is politicizing this, they're just saying, hey, we're plugging this in our models, and this is what we're coming up with. Well, think about it. A model is making assumptions based on past history. What past history do we have where the government has had major layoffs and has had an extreme reduction in spending? I think probably none since 1946. So, of course, their models are wrong because there's nothing in recent history to draw on for the actual results. In any case, I'm out of time. Thanks for all the questions. Until next time, this is John Pugliano from Investable Wealth and the Wealth Setting Podcast.
All right, time for my segment today. One of the big concerns with AI, and it is a legitimate concern. I think it's an overblown concern, but I also think it's legitimate. I don't think AI is going to replace every job that humans do today, but it is going to definitely allow for the reduction of headcount in a lot of jobs that right now, I think they're, just to be blunt, I think there's a lot of people out there that are fairly well paid. They work a 40-hour week by the numbers, but when you really look at what they do, maybe they work 20 hours of actual work, and they're there because there's a budget that allows for them to be there, and there's something that they do that when they're necessary, it's useful. Those people are going to get hammered by this because what I can do with AI in a lot of situations is take five people like that, fire four of them, give one of them the job of all five, and give them AI tools to accomplish that job with, and pay them better, and everything is better for me, everything's better for my customer, everything's better for the guy that kept his job and is now more fairly rewarded, and it sucks for the four people that have to go. I'm not saying four out of five jobs in general. I'm saying in some locations, four out of five jobs will be pretty standard. So Andrew, who I've known for quite a while, he's been very useful and helpful to me with things involving starting plants, some hacks on preventing diseases, some hydroponic stuff, etc. He sent me an email not having to do with any of that stuff. He says, I've been talking to ChatGPT about AI-driven future and the changing role of humanity. Here's what it came up with. How to prepare for a world where your labor is no longer necessary. I guess this was his prompt. We're moving toward a reality where AI and automation could make most traditional jobs obsolete. The best way to prepare is to future-proof yourself in some key areas. AI says, develop unique human skills. Creativity and innovation, AI can generate ideas, but human ingenuity is invaluable. Focus on storytelling, art, design, philosophy, and problem solving. The issue with that is Storytelling, art, and design generally don't really make a lot of money unless you're like a big-time author or something. Problem solving and design, yeah, those are areas where there's still a lot of opportunity, and AI tools can make you more capable in those situations. It also says emotional intelligence and leadership. AI can analyze emotions, but can't replace the deep human connection. Strengthening your ability to lead, mentor, and inspire will help keep you relevant. I would agree. B, own resources and assets. I totally agree with this one. Land, food production, and real-world skills, hunting, fishing, building will always have value, even in a high-tech world. If labor becomes unnecessary, wealth will likely shift toward those who own things that AI can't fabricate from thin air. Interesting. And the reality is there's nothing that's physical that AI can fabricate from thin air that doesn't require other resources to get it done. Even if we're talking, you know, tying AI into 3D printing so that we can design things very rapidly, you still need the printer, you still need the filament, etc. And you still need to know how to use the product that comes out or market the product that comes out and things like that. But owning things is actually the secret to stability of wealth right now, and it has been for thousands of years. The wealthy own and control things. You know, the poor work for money. That's not really a new thing. Embrace technology and stay adaptable. Rather than resisting, I learn how to use it to your advantage. Explore new digital economies like AI-assisted entrepreneurship, content creation, and even VR-based experiences. D, strengthen community and philosophy. If work disappears, purpose will come from shared experiences, relationships, and meaningful projects. Consider what truly makes life fulfilling outside economic productivity. And Andrew said he thought it was interesting that it's one of its suggestions was to own resources. I went and asked a similar question to see if it would give me a little bit different of an answer. There was some similarities and some differences. What I asked, and I said, one big concern people have about AI is that many jobs will go away and may not have much opportunity in their current profession. What can people do to be better prepared for this? Here's AI's response. You're absolutely right. AI is already shifting the job landscape, and it's normal to feel uneasy about that. But here's the good news. While some roles will disappear or change drastically, others will emerge. The key is to adapt ahead of time. Here's a few practical ways people can prepare. One, learn to work with AI, not against it. In most fields, AI won't replace people entirely, but people who can use AI will replace those who can't. Start exploring tools relevant to your profession now. Think about how that's been the case over and over and over and over again. You know, if we go back to the 1960s, we used to have typing pools. Women who went to work every day, worked 40 hours a week, all they did was type shit and make copies of shit. What happened? Xerox machine came out. There are no more typing pools. There's still people that use the Xerox machine. Imagine being in 1965 and saying, I don't want to learn how a copier works. Yeah. Two, focus on human skills AI can't replicate. Critical thinking, creativity, emotional intelligence, communication, leadership, adaptability. These will all become more valuable, not less. I completely agree. Three, keep learning and stay flexible. The most resilient workers will be lifelong learners. Already true, always been true, okay? Micro certifications, online courses, and even just messing around with new tech on your own can go a long way. Absolutely. Absolutely. This is why people in their 40s and 50s get hammered in career shifts anyway, even without something as destabilizing or disruption as AI. It's always happened this way. If you're 25, when the internet rolls out and email becomes part of daily work and everybody's using computers to do something at work, unless they're like, I don't know, swinging wrenches or something like that, or hammers. But, you know, the office environment was invaded by computers about the mid-90s. People who were 25 years old just rolled with it. And you think, well, they already knew how to... No, they didn't, because we didn't have computers at home very much yet. They just, because they were willing to be adaptable, and that's just what we got to do now, and they didn't know, well, we've always done it on paper, right? They didn't know that, so they just did it. But the person that was like 55 trying to make it to 65 to retire often got just rolled over by all that, by the young crowd coming in, the aggressive, and then the reduction of headcount. Who you can get rid of? The 25-year-old guy that got with the program, or the 55-year-old guy that bitches all the time that he doesn't want to do it the new way? Yeah? Okay. So it's not really different. It's just a different scenario of the same outcome, right? This is my favorite one out of everything ChatGPT said to me. Look for problems, not just jobs. If you can identify a pain point and use AI or other tools to solve it, you're creating your own opportunity, whether that's freelancing, entrepreneurship, or consulting. Yeah, I've said this before. We will never run out of jobs until we run out of problems. And the number one way to identify opportunity is to find problems and then develop solutions to those problems, right? And unfortunately, we have a lot of people, because everybody wants to be an entrepreneur today, they do it absolutely differently. They find a solution and then try to adapt it to a problem, right? Like, so I'm looking for something to sell. Here's the thing maybe I can sell, and so I have to create a problem that lets me sell the thing. Where if you can actually identify the problem first, and then a lot of times it's not inventing a solution, it's assembling a solution. This thing over here, that thing over there, and this thing over here, when combined along with me, becomes a solution to this problem that these people have. And now you market that. And you don't market, I take these three things and solve your problem. You say, you have a problem and I can fix it for this much money. And some people say, okay, here's the money, fix it. And if you fix it, they say, I'm happy now. And they tell other people, hey, I had the problem and he fixed it. That mindset. That has always been the mindset of the entrepreneur, the successful entrepreneur. Diversify your income streams. This isn't just an AI issue. Having side hustles, investments, or part-time gigs gives you breathing room if your primary job shifts back to own resources, right? And then it asked me if I want to know, and I said, I think a way to prepare might be by owning resources. I wanted to go deeper on that, and here's what it said. Absolutely, owning resources is one of the smartest long-term strategies because ownership is harder to automate away. When you own, you're not just a participant in the economy, you leverage it. Here's how owning resources can prepare you for an AI-driven future. Land and food production. AI can't replace a garden, a greenhouse, or a few laying hens. Owning even a small plot of land gives you real security and productive capacity. Tools and equipment. Whether it's a CNC machine, a 3D printer, or just a chainsaw, and a compost setup, owning tools gives you independence and service trade value. Digital assets, a website, a podcast, an email list, or even a well-trained AI chatbot you own can generate income or amplify other ventures. Knowledge and skills as resources. When you master a skill, welding, coding, herbalism, teaching, you become the resource. Pair it with tools or land and you're unstoppable. Network and community, not a physical asset, but arguably the most resilient one. Being in a trusted network, especially of skilled people, can give you access to shared tools, market, and support. In other words, the thing that we look at as being dehumanizing, artificial intelligence, may actually lead to a renaissance of humanizing. And I'll tell you, that sounds crazy until you really think about it. And here's what I mean by really think about it. If we go back 1,000 years and into more of a historically normal thing for humans. And if we get out of the city states and the monarchies and we get out into where people lived like they did for 300,000 or more years, at least 350,000 years is how old we think modern humans are now. And I personally believe that number is going to get pushed way back as we continue to explore and learn. But if we go back to that time period, if we go look at how indigenous societies live, there's a lot of shit we do that they don't. And this allows for time, interaction, and community, and song, and dance, and time around the fire, and everything else. Here's what I mean. Like, you go back 1,000 years, who had a human resources department? Even if you had a school, did they have, like, a bunch of administrators? Or did they just have people that knew shit that told the young people how to do shit? Even in a formalized school, there was like no administration whatsoever, really. Teachers and students, that was it. Think of how many things we do that are pointless bullshit or for the generation of doodads that no one really needs. Think about the fact that right now, as the oldest boomers continue to die off and leave all their stuff, and even a few of the silents that are still around are dying off, and they're leaving all their stuff to their Gen X and Millennial kids. The Gen X and Millennial kids are dumping them all into antique warehouses or just throwing them away or whatever. They don't want them. Now, what's funny is you see the Gen X kids and the Millennial kids, right, which are now middle-aged men and women, mocking it in some ways, and yet they're still buying their doodads that one day the their Gen Alpha and Gen Z kids will throw away. You see that repeated process there. So if you get into a situation where a lot of these mundane tasks that people do just to have jobs that don't really need to be done, I'm telling you right now, 40% of the workforce, if they didn't go to work, literally nothing would happen. Yes, maybe it would be harder to get some little doodad or something that you're going to put on your window, but in the end, no one would die, no one would starve, nothing would happen, right? Many companies, I could walk in, identify 40% of the workforce, lay them all off. There'd be a little bit of disgruntled adaptation, but once everybody adapted, and if I said I'm going to take the salary from the 40%, take half of it, put it to the company's bottom line, and the other half of it, and distribute it as a salary bump to everybody that's still here, suddenly everybody would be a lot happier, and the company would not even lose a stroke in, like, let's say, over a quarter to a year, right? And you know this. If you've been in any company more than, let's say, a headcount of 50, you can walk around and see people that we don't really need this person. Right, so if AI starts replacing that type of meaningless worker, right, because they're only really there for like few times a week they're actually necessary, and then AI can take care of it, then you start to have less and less of this make work mindset. There is a lot of people out there, and I'm not saying you're a bad person. I'm just saying if you didn't go to work, it wouldn't really matter. No one would die, no one would starve, and the company would just go along. So if we start eliminating a lot of these jobs that are just make work jobs, and we start having to seek value, if we have to start seeking community, if we have to start seeking a deeper connection, then maybe what gets monetized is that. Maybe that becomes the thing. You know, I follow this one guy on TikTok, for instance. He's called The Steak and Egg. He used to be cooking at keto. He does plenty of things that aren't keto now, and I think he changed his name to do that. But he's basically set up this incredible dining facility in what is his backyard. And it's like he does like one big meal a week that you have to get on a list to go to. It. If you think this guy's just selling food, you're out of your mind. He's selling that whole connective experience, all these people coming together and meeting each other and hearing about the food they're eating and being in that environment, right? Like, these are the things that people are actually going to do for value, is create experiences. And that has the ability to actually lead us back to more, not less, human connection. I ain't saying it's all going to be daisies, and I'm not going to say that people are not going to get steamrolled by it, but the people that embrace it, that's what you're seeking, in my view. Anyway, Andrew, thank you for that little side project and sending it over to me. I think it's a cool thing. Hey, if anybody ever comes up with a cool discussion with AI that you think would make a good show segment or topic, send it to me. Or any questions you have or any thoughts you have, always you can send them to me, jack@thesurvivalpodcast.com. jack@thesurvivalpodcast.com. TSPC in the subject line. We'll make sure I dig it out of the spam folder if it ends up there. And if you've never emailed me before, it's probably 50-50 that it's gonna. Once you've emailed me a few times, and I've probably, if you've been in there before, I've probably marked you never spam mark this person, but it's a best practice anyway. TSPC in the subject line, your question, your comment, whatever, in one sentence, or hey, hit return and then give me details, and I'll be likely to be able to do a really good job for you. Anyway, with that, we have wrapped up the week. Tomorrow you'll have a Friday flashback, and then next week we'll do it all again. And I'm thinking next week we'll go without interruption. I have no travel planned until next month when I'm cruising up to Tennessee to hang out with Nicole Awesome Sauce and the whole crew up there for Living Free in Tennessee, LFTN 25. So until then, we will have regular scheduled programming unless something crazy happens. Take care, guys, and I'll catch you tomorrow with that flashback.
They said you should have a house the American way. $1 down, $1 a month, and you never have to pay.